Today we will speak of the greatness of Groundhog Day. The quirky comedy may seem a strange choice with which to begin our faith and film series, especially right before the holiest day of the Jewish year. But I can guarantee you, ladies and gentlemen, that this is not the first time that a clergyman has delivered a religious reflection on the film. The writer General Goldberg, in an article 12 years after the movie premiered, tells us that, quote, "I asked readers to send in their views on the film. Over 200 emails later, I had learned that countless professors use it to teach ethics and a host of philosophical approaches. Several pastors sent me excerpts from sermons in which Groundhog Day was the central metaphor, and dozens of committed Christians of all denominations related that it was one of their most cherished movies." So he writes, and we are further informed that the religious love of Groundhog Day is downright ecumenical. In a fabulous reflection, Harold Ramis, the director of Groundhog Day, describes the interfaith religious reaction to the movie that he had made, including an extraordinary anecdote about some enterprising Chabad Hasidim. Here are Harold Ramis's reflections.
It's a metaphor for a lot of things, which was brought home to me when the movie opened. My producing partner, Trevor Albert, called me on Sunday. The movie opened on a Friday. On Sunday, he called me and said, there are pickets outside the theater in Santa Monica. And I said, what are they protesting? He said, they're not protesting. They're Hasidic Jews walking around with signs that say, are you living the same day over and over again? And then, call the Chabad, I guess. So then I started getting, almost immediately, my mother-in-law lived for 35 years in a Zen Buddhist meditation center to the end of her life. And I called her right away on the weekend, and she said they saw it. The abbots and the senior monks, she said they loved it. They thought it expresses a fundamental Buddhist concept. And then I heard from people in the yoga community that it was everything that they were about. And then I started getting letters from Catholic priests and Christian and Baptist ministers saying this totally expresses our philosophy. You must be Christians, obviously, because it's such a Christian, devoutly Christian movie. And then the psychiatric community chimed in and said, obviously, the movie is a metaphor for psychoanalysis.
Thus, I am not alone in finding religious significance in Groundhog Day. If I may paraphrase praise that it has received from Jonah Goldberg and others, Groundhog Day presents us with a parable about time, for our time and for all time. And there is, of course, therefore, no better time to ponder this movie about time than at the turning point in the Jewish year when we mark a passage of sacred time, thereby inspiring us to consider the Jewish approach to time. I offer, therefore, this evening a rabbinic reading of Groundhog Day, and I will do so by contrasting the film with another important work in the history of Western civilization, Shakespeare's tragedy, Macbeth, which may not be as incredible a masterpiece as Groundhog Day, but is still an important work in the history of our culture. And so we begin, ladies and gentlemen, with one of the most famous of Shakespearean soliloquies, and it occurs at the end of Macbeth. The man who has murdered his way to the top learns that his partner in life and his partner in crime, Lady Macbeth, driven mad by guilt, has committed suicide. Macbeth replies, she should have died hereafter, which is either a wish that she had lived longer or an expression that she would have died eventually. He then goes on to reflect upon the very nature of time, which from his perspective is meaningless. He does so in poetic, powerful words, and we give it to you today as delivered by one of the great Shakespearean actors of our age, Ian McKellen, Gandalf himself.
Tomorrow. And tomorrow. And tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life is but a walking shadow. A poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
Let us unpack what Macbeth has just said. What we have here, of course, is a meditation on the nature of life, a reflection that our mortality makes life meaningless. Macbeth compares our lives to candles. Out, out, brief candle. However brilliant these lives may seem, this brilliance is brief. Thus, he is saying, to revel in our lives is foolish. Out, out, brief candle. And because life is meaningless, time itself, Macbeth says, is nothing but a series of insignificant events, one after another. An endless series of yesterdays are followed, in his words, by tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. Now here, ladies and gentlemen, is what interests me. Macbeth dismisses the significance of life by comparing it to a brief candle. This is why we are insignificant, or as he says, signifying nothing. And in truth, the comparison between human life and the candle is one that the Bible itself adopts. For Proverbs tells us that Ner Hashem Nishmat Adam, the soul of man, is the candle or the lamp of God. And yet, the fragile, candle-like nature of our existence seems to us in Judaism to be all the more precious for its fragility. And for us, as we know, the candle is kindled by Jews not in nihilistic despair, but in holiness and hope, in sanctity and celebration. We proclaim every Friday afternoon, not out, out, brief candle, but rather, blessed are you, O Lord, who has commanded us to kindle the candle of the sacred Sabbath. We do not deny the brevity of the candle's flickering luminescence, so why do we disagree? And where do we disagree with Macbeth? In answering this question, we turn from Shakespeare back to Groundhog Day, a modern work of cinematic genius which is often linked to Macbeth's soliloquy about tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow, but which is rightly understood actually expressing the exact opposite of Macbeth's approach. Let us review the plot, and spoiler alert. Groundhog Day stars the great actor Bill Murray as Phil Connors, a cynical and selfish weatherman who travels to the town of Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, in order to do a puff piece on the emergence of the groundhog on Groundhog Day in that locale. He looks down upon all those in the town as simpletons. He believes that this particular report that he's been assigned is utterly beneath him, hence his sarcastic comment when he first delivers his broadcast. He says, "This is the one time where television cannot truly capture the drama of a large rodent predicting the weather." He then treats everyone rudely, goes to sleep in his motel, wakes up the next day only to experience Groundhog Day once again. He keeps waking up morning after morning in Punxsutawney, and it's always February 2nd, always the 2nd, with the radio always blaring, it's Groundhog Day. Now at first, Murray's character embraces his time stasis, realizing that he can do whatever he wants without consequences, as he'll just wake up at the beginning of that same day. But he eventually grows frustrated. He attempts to end his life, but still wakes up in his bed on February 2nd. And finally, having come to know in intricate detail everything that happens in the town on February 2nd, he focuses on using every minute of that day toward a good purpose. For his broadcast about the event about which he has reported day after day after day already, he suddenly sees in a reflection on winter and the coming of spring, every sign of the glory of life, and then goes from his broadcast in an attempt, based on his knowledge of all that occurs, to utilize every second of time for a good end. He fixes the flat tires of those in need, and he eventually learns to love a woman, Rita, played by Andie MacDowell, who originally was spiritually far out of his league. Finally, at the end of this day, having spent every instant of February 2nd in a proper way, having lived a perfect day, Phil actually wakes up the next morning, and it's February 3rd. Tomorrow finally came. In other words, only after Phil has grown to appreciate the preciousness of time is he allowed to experience time. The movie intentionally uses the word tomorrow constantly as representing the moment in time that Phil longs for but cannot reach. In Macbeth's soliloquy, the word tomorrow signifies meaninglessness, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. But Phil Connors, Bill Murray, sees things from the exact opposite perspective. Trapped in frozen time, he desperately desires to experience tomorrow. When he first experiences this time loop, he asks somebody, "What if tomorrow didn't come? It didn't today." And then he asks someone at a bar, "Let me ask you guys a question. What if there were no tomorrow?" And the guy says, "That would mean there would be no consequences. There'd be no hangovers. We could do whatever we wanted." And Phil says, "That's true. We could do whatever we want." And so he begins to live an utterly narcissistic life, so much so that Rita, the woman in whom he is interested, looks at his narcissistic, meaningless existence and applies to him a poem from Sir Walter Scott. We give you this very short and wonderfully comedic scene.
I like to see a man of advancing years throwing caution to the wind. It's inspiring in a way.
My years are not advancing as fast as you might think.
More coffee, hon?
Yeah, just keep it coming, please.
Sure thing.
There's real nice. Just put that anywhere, pal.
Good save.
Don't you worry about cholesterol, lung cancer, love handles?
I don't worry about anything anymore.
What makes you so special? Everybody worries about something.
Well, that's exactly what makes me so special. I don't even have to floss. What?
The wretch, concentred all in self, living shall forfeit fair renown, and doubly dying shall go down to the vile dust from whence he sprung, unwept, unhonored, and unsung, Sir Walter Scott.
So as you see, originally Phil laughs this off, but he eventually realizes that she is right. He has become a wretch. He impacts no one. If he died, he would be unwept, unhonored, and unsung. And so eventually he seeks to become a person worthy of Rita's love, even though he knows that whatever he does, Rita and everyone will forget about it by the next morning when time begins again. But he will not forget. He will continue to work on himself. In other words, he changes, and in changing himself, he is ultimately given the gift of change, ultimately achieves time moving forward again. He is suddenly blessed to experience tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. And what this means, contra Macbeth, that what gives life meaning is tomorrow. The fact that we are free in the way we act today to make tomorrow different, not just in the world, but in who we are, that we are ourselves able to change so the person that we are tomorrow is better, different than today. And in this respect, the difference between Judaism and Macbeth's soliloquy can now be understood. The fascinating fact is that we as Jews do not disagree with Macbeth, that life, like a brief candle, goes out. We do not disagree that life is, in his words, a walking shadow, and that we die a dusty death. The fact is that there is a striking similarity between Macbeth's soliloquy and the centerpiece of the Ashkenazic High Holy Day liturgy, which many of you have just said unetana tokef. Macbeth said that we are like a walking shadow. The Hebrew prayer says the same thing, that we are kitzel over, a shadow that passes. Macbeth speaks of us walking to a dusty death. Unetana tokef says, Adam yisodo me'afar v'sofo le'afar. Man is founded from dust and will end in dust. For Macbeth, we are a candle blown out. And for the Unetana tokef prayer, we are kiruach noshevet kachalom ya'uf, like a passing wind and like a dream from which one awakes. We as Jews believe all of this. But what makes our perspective different is that in the midst of this life, whose time is limited, there is freedom within. It's not just that we have an immortal soul that we do. We do. But even within this life, in this brief life, there is freedom. And just as we know that a small flickering flame contains within it an almost unlimited power, so too we are free to impact the world profoundly. For Macbeth, in contrast, in his soliloquy, it is freedom that is denied. Note Macbeth's words. He says, "We are a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more." The phrase "a poor player" means an actor. Ian McKellen, in an interview about the scene, and I urge you to go online and find the interview where he actually talks about this performance, he notes that part of the power of the scene is that Macbeth in performance compares human beings to an actor and thereby draws in the audience who realizes that they are watching a play. The play, in other words, has become a metaphor for life. For Macbeth, all human beings are players. We are all actors. All is set by the script. We're not going to change what's going to happen. And from this perspective, life is tragic. And Macbeth, of course, is the embodiment of the great tragedy, steered by fate toward his end. This, of course, is not the Jewish perspective on life, because Judaism does not believe that we are just actors or players following a script. It was Rabbi Jonathan Sacks who once explained why the Jewish conception of linear time differs dramatically from the tragic conception of life. In fact, Rabbi Sacks points out that in Hebrew, there isn't actually a word for the literary genre known as tragedy. Today, of course, when we use the word tragedy, we just mean it as to mean a misfortune. It's like when Benjamin Disraeli was once asked, "What's the difference between a misfortune and a tragedy?" And Disraeli said, "Well, let's take Gladstone." Gladstone was this great political rival. He said, "If Gladstone tripped and fell into the Thames River, that would be a misfortune. But if somebody pulled him out, that would be a tragedy." But the fact is, of course, tragedy refers to a certain type of literary genre where fate ensures a terrible end. I actually saw Ian McKellen live, much older, as King Lear in London. And I think it was during the intermission that I went to the gift shop at the Royal Shakespeare, and they had a play listing all of Shakespeare's tragedies on it, with the number of people who died in each one of the tragedies. And above it, on the t-shirt, it just said in big letters, "Everybody dies." That's tragedy. Now, what is the Hebrew word for the literary genre known as tragedy? It's tragedia, because there is no Hebrew word for tragedy. And Rabbi Sacks explained why. He explained it by pointing out another word which doesn't exist in Hebrew. This is what he said, quote, "What I discovered when my books were being translated into Hebrew is that this ancient language, 4,000 years old, has no word for person, and this created enormous difficulties for my translators. Hebrew has ish, which means a man, adam, which roughly means homo sapiens, and nosh, which means immortal, and ben adam, which means son of man, but no word that corresponds to person. Why? The answer, he said, lies in the history of the word person itself. It comes from the Latin persona, which means a mask, specifically a mask worn by a character on a stage. In other words, he said, it refers to a role played within a theatrical drama. It's a metaphor that belongs to cultures that can say with Shakespeare, life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. Cultures, said Rabbi Sacks, that do not see the world as a stage, do not see people as persons, that is, as actors in a play. That is why they lack the concept of tragedy, because the essence of tragedy is that it has a prescriptive ending. You know from the beginning that it's all going to end in tears. But, Rabbi Sacks added, an opera can be tragic, but life itself cannot, meaning from Jewish perspective, if you believe that there is human freedom that we can change. That, he added, is why in Judaism there is no word for tragedy, because the story hasn't ended yet. And life is life, not art. And so from the Jewish perspective, we are not a poor player, we are free to change. And this is the change that Bill Murray's character undergoes. And in so doing, in actually changing, in ceasing to be the narcissistic wretch that he was, he actually frees himself thereby from time stasis and experiences linear time restored. In changing himself and in showing himself free to change himself, he then experiences the gift of change within time itself. This is, I believe, therefore, a profoundly Jewish film because, rightly understood, it is the Jews that gave the concept of linear time and of change within time to the world. Thomas Cahill, a non-Jew, wrote a best-selling book which is titled The Gift of the Jews, How a Tribe of Desert Nomads Changed the Way Everyone Thinks and Feels. And in the book, he notes that the ancient world saw time as inherently cyclical and therefore assumed that life on earth mirrored the cycles of the planets and the stars in heaven, and that history did not progress. People never improved. No one could live a truly revolutionary life. And all this, Cahill writes, was changed by a Mesopotamian man by the name of Abram, son of an idolater, who suddenly decided to change his entire life, to leave his land, to found a faith and a family, risking everything on the belief that men and women can defy their fate. Cahill recounts how the world might have reacted to Abraham's insight. He writes, if we had lived in the second millennium BC, the millennium of Avram, and could have canvassed all the nations of the earth, what would they have said of Avram's journey? In most of Africa and Europe, they would have laughed at Avram's madness. The early Greeks might have told Avram the story of Prometheus, whose quest for the fire of the gods ended in personal disaster. Do not overreach, they would advise. Come to resignation. The ancestors of the Maya in America would point to their circular calendars and would explain that everything that has been comes around again, that each man's fate is fixed. And then he adds, on every continent and every society, Avram would have been given the same advice that wise men as diverse as Heraclitus, Lao Tzu, and Siddhartha would one day give their followers. Do not journey, but sit. Compose yourself by the river of life. So Cahill writes, and he therefore argues that the two most revolutionary words in the Torah come right after God told Abraham to leave his land to found a new faith and a family. Those words are, Vayelech Avram. Abram went, meaning he went for it. These words, he writes, quote, signal a complete departure from everything that has gone before in the long evolution of culture and sensibility. That is why, he argues in his book, everyone, in thinking about the very possibility of change, is actually being Jewish. Or, as he writes, we can hardly get up in the morning and cross the street without being Jewish. Most of our best words, new, adventure, surprise, future, freedom, progress, faith, and hope, all these words, he writes, are the gifts of the Jews. So, true freedom, then, is the ability to utilize time in the present, to change, to connect past and future. Judaism gave to the world a linear concept of time, in which not only is today followed by tomorrow, but tomorrow is impacted by our free choices today. Or as Jonah Goldberg writes about Groundhog Day, quote, the point is that Connor slowly realizes that what makes life worth living is not what you get from it, but what you put into it. Connor's himself, in other words, changes. The cycles of time seem to have trapped him, but he defies the cyclical cul-de-sac in which he finds himself, and he becomes a better person than he was. The film presents us a parable of what Judaism gave to the world, what is the gifts of the Jews. But there is more, ladies and gentlemen, to the film than this. Jonah Goldberg in his essay further observes that the film has attracted interpretations from every religion, but of all the sentences written about Groundhog Day, the best, I think, comes from the historian Richard Brookhiser, who writes as follows. Listen to this. The curse is lifted when Bill Murray blesses the day he has just lived, and his reward is that the day is taken from him. Loving life includes loving the fact that it goes. Loving life includes loving the fact that it goes. In other words, in time we are free, but it is the very finitude of the time we are given that makes our freedom within time so exquisitely precious. That is precisely why at the turning of time, at this very time of year, our liturgy describes the very finitude and fragility of life, but also the power of human beings to be inspired thereby to embrace the preciousness of life and to change within the time that life provides. The very fact that time goes is what makes it precious. Or as the Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik put it, Jews cherish the fleeting moment as if it represented eternity. Every year is valuable. Every second is precious. I often quote a story that I heard, at least in the name of Justice Stephen Breyer, former Justice of the United States Supreme Court, that he or some Harvard professor was grading exams at Harvard Law School. And he came upon one page where the student wrote to the professor, "Professor, I want you to know that if I had 1 hour left to live, I would want to spend that hour sitting in your class." And the professor was very flattered. And then he turned the page and he saw that the student continued by writing, "Because, Professor, an hour in your class feels like an eternity." The truth is, for Jewish law and for Judaism, 1 hour or even less can make an eternity of difference. How we spend one moment of time can actually impact how we will be received as immortal spiritual beings upon entering eternity in the world to come. Every bit of time on earth is precious. The fact that it is brief does not detract from its preciousness, because loving life includes loving the fact that it goes. And so this is the Jewish approach. This is what we focus on this time of year: freedom within time and the very finitude of time. In Groundhog Day, we are offered a choice in how we wish to live. We can be the wretch that Bill Murray was, caught without tomorrows, or we can be who Bill Murray became. Time moves forward. The question is whether we live as if it does. Because the truth is, ladies and gentlemen, though we are not caught in a metaphysical Groundhog Day, we often act as if we are. We often allow the very busyness of time to actually allow us to float within time without actually changing ourselves. And the irony is that in our age, when technology allows us to so precisely parcel time, it is all too often time that controls us, rather than we that take control of every portion of our time. In a famous article in The New Yorker, Adam Gopnik introduced us to a character by the name of Charlie Ravioli, which was the name of his daughter Olivia's imaginary friend. As Gopnik describes, what makes this imaginary friend unusual is that he was always too busy to play with Olivia. Gopnik describes Olivia holding up her toy cell phone, saying into it, "Ravioli, it's Olivia. Come and play? Okay, call me, bye." And then he writes, "She snaps it shut and shakes her head. I always get his machine," she says. On a good day, Gopnik writes, she bumps into her invisible friend and they go to a coffee shop. "I bumped into Charlie Ravioli," she announces at dinner. "We had coffee, but then he had to run." So Gopnik was a little worried, and as he tells us in the article, he called his sister, Allison Gopnik, in California, who's a very famous child psychologist. And she said to him, "Look, it's not unusual for a child to have an imaginary friend." So he said to her, he said to her something to the effect of, "I understand that, but have you ever heard of an imaginary friend that's too busy to play with you?" And she responded something like, "No, I've never seen anything like that in the psychological literature. That sounds completely New York." And then she hung up. Gopnik then goes on to describe another imaginary friend that appeared on the scene, whose name was Lori. Lori, Gopnik tells us, was, they assumed, the person that Olivia had gone to for consolation because Charlie Ravioli was too busy to play with her. But, he writes, a little while later, a more ominous side of Lori's role began to appear. "Lori, tell Ravioli I'm calling," I heard Olivia say. I pressed her about who exactly Lori was. Olivia shook her head. "He works for Ravioli," she said. And then Gopnik writes, it came to us with sickening clarity. Lori was not the patient friend who consoled you for Charlie's absence. Lori was the bright-toned person who answered Ravioli's phone and told you that, unfortunately, Mr. Ravioli was in a meeting. In other words, this is the person who works for Ravioli. This is the assistant in the office of Ravioli. And so he describes how he called his sister again in California, and she told him that she had never heard of such a thing. As he puts it, an imaginary friend with a personal assistant to run interference for him. So he says to his sister, "You think we should look into it?" So she replies, "I think you should move." Now, Gopnik's point about the adult world is clear, as clear to us as it was to Olivia, whether or not we live in New York. We are so busy with life that we often fail to focus on it to savor the parts that are truly significant. Or as Gopnik puts it, the crowding of our space has been reinforced by a crowding of our time. And the only way to protect ourselves is to build structures, is to build structures of perpetual deferral. I'll see you next week. Let's talk soon. He writes, "I have one intimate who lives just across the park from me, whom I email often, and whom I am fortunate to see two or three times a year. We are always busy. He has become my Charlie Ravioli," he writes. "I am sure that he misses me," he adds, "just as Charlie Ravioli," I realized, "must tell his other friends how much he misses Olivia." Meanwhile, Adam Gopnik concludes, Olivia is still trying to reach her closest friend. Gopnik describes in the article hearing Olivia talking to herself as she goes to sleep. "Ravioli, ravioli," she moans as she turns over into her pillow and clutches her blanket. And then she whispers almost to herself, "Tell him call me. Tell him call me when he comes home." We are created to be able to recognize the preciousness of time and to be free in time. But the story of Ravioli reminds us that not all of us chooses to act within time as we ought. Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik writes that, quote, "Not every human being takes advantage of the unique human endowment to experience time, to live time, rather than to live in time." True freedom, in other words, is to be the master of our time. But mastering time only comes with an understanding and appreciation of time's finitude. And that, I think, ladies and gentlemen, is why Judaism disagrees with Macbeth, and why it embraces the lighting of a Shabbat candle as one of the most resonant images in Jewish ritual life. The greeting of Shabbat, rightly understood, by the kindling of a candle, is not, as is often said, the experience of a pause in time, but rather a moment when we experience the rush of time, for there is no more frenzied time than the period right before Shabbat. And it's at that moment that we resolve for 24 hours to sanctify time. This is captured wonderfully by the 19th century Jewish painter Moritz Daniel Oppenheim in his painting Shabbat Anfang, and we'll put this on the screen. Shabbat Anfang, the beginning of the Sabbath. Here you see the mother of the household accepting the Shabbat by blessing the Judenstern, the Jewish Shabbat lamp, as the sun descends. And in a fabulous stereotype of German-Jewish fashion, because German Jews are known for their punctuality, the husband holds aloft his watch, looking intently at it, ensuring that the candles are lit in time, meaning he is watching the time as she sanctifies time. And look, ladies and gentlemen, at the painting for a moment at the table behind them. The husband holding the watch is optically lined up with the two symbols sanctifying the Sabbath. You see the candles or the Shabbat lamp being blessed by his wife, and the cup of Kiddush, the cup on which he will sanctify the Sabbath when he returns from the synagogue. The watch, in other words, is the sign of time's finitude. It proceeds from minute to minute, hour to hour, tomorrow to tomorrow to tomorrow. But that is why time is precious, why it must be seized, why it must be sanctified. Shabbat is about time. We enter it recognizing its finitude and therefore its preciousness, which in turn reminds us of life's finitude and therefore its preciousness. And that is supposed to impact our approach to life on Shabbat and thereby throughout the week. And this point is made by Oppenheim in his companion painting, depicting the bidding farewell to Shabbat. And here you see another sort of candle being lit, the candle of Havdalah, the candle on which we say farewell to the Sabbath. As many of you know, what sets this candle apart from other Jewish ritual lights is that it has more than one wick, more than one flame, at least two wicks that are intertwined. Look at what Oppenheim does in this painting. On the left side of the painting, you see the Sabbath lamp with many wicks. It's been burning all Sabbath, but only two flames are still burning. Those two flames are separate from one another. As a contrast, on the right side, the Havdalah candle is held aloft, and its flames, its wicks, are joined. Behind the candle, shrouded in darkness but drawing hope from the light, are a mother and daughter who are themselves intertwined in a hug. The wicks are intertwined, and in embrace, human beings are intertwined. Remember the quote from Proverbs with which we began. The soul of man is the candle of God. In this painting, mother and daughter in a link of love have become a candle of Havdalah, of two souls merged. On Shabbat, the wicks are not joined, but as we bid farewell to Shabbat, the wicks of Havdalah are, because precisely when Jews enter the real world, a world of pain and suffering and striving, it is union with others that truly brings light to our world and is the source of our ability to give life and light to others. And so like Macbeth, ladies and gentlemen, we look at a candle and we know that it will go out soon. And if we use candles to bless and sanctify the Sabbath, to greet it and to bid farewell to it, it is because loving time means loving the fact that it goes. And if on Erev Yom Kippur, as so many do, candles are lit in memory of those we loved that are gone, it is because we are remembering how their lives are intertwined with us, how they have impacted us, how their today impacted their tomorrow, even when they were no longer here. We look at those candles and we ponder the finite and therefore the precious opportunity that life offers us. Loving life means loving the fact that it goes. And so, in the way we live on earth, as many of you will say on Yom Kippur, in Unetanat Hokef, our lives are indeed like a passing shadow, like a brief candle. No one would deny it. But that time is rendered all the more precious because of it. The candle made all the more radiant. There is a very famous story told about Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who, this is one version of the story found online, came upon a shoemaker who was fixing shoes by the light of a dimly lit dying candle. And so Rabbi Salanter said, "Your candle is about to die, it's flickering. Time to go to sleep." And the shoemaker said something, according to this version found online, that shook Rabbi Salanter. The shoemaker said, "As the candle burns, there is still time to repair. As long as the candle burns, there is still time to repair." So this version of the story goes. If we are still in time, if our candle still burns, we have time to repair. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, I'm pretty sure, never saw Groundhog Day. But someone who did appear in the film ended up expressing in his own way exactly what the story is attempting to express. Decades after Groundhog Day's film premiere, a musical version of the movie premiered on Broadway. And that premiere had a very special guest who then decided after seeing the play that seeing it once was not enough. Thus, a TV report about the Broadway premiere tells us the following.
It seems like Bill Murray is experiencing a real-life Groundhog Day time loop. The iconic movie went to Broadway for the second night in a row. The actor went to the Groundhog Day musical to see the adaptation of his classic 1993 comedy. Now, listen to this. During his second visit, a New York Times writer tweeted, "This is not a joke. Bill Murray went to see the Groundhog Day musical again." So, living out the actual movie, the actor took time to pose with fans, hang out with the cast, including Andy Carl, who plays Murray's role, Phil Connors. The New York Times reports that Murray was really into it. He was visibly sobbing by the end of night one. I mean, it's like your life flashes before your eyes again.
He didn't want to see it end, so he kept going back.
He kept going.
And so there you have it. He went to see Groundhog Day, and then he went to see Groundhog Day again. And note the report that he was sobbing at the end of the premiere. Or, as the New York Times put it, Mr. Murray, quote, was in tears. He waited a minute to compose himself before joining the rest of the audience to cheer the cast. In an interview afterwards, Mr. Murray said it was the message behind the story brought to life on stage that made him weep. I'm continuing the quote from the article. The idea that, Mr. Murray trailed off as he paused to collect his thoughts, the idea that we just have to try again. We just have to try again. It's such a beautiful, powerful idea. End quote. Indeed. Or as long as the candle still burns, there is time to repair. We need not be trapped by time, because the soul of man is indeed the candle of God, and we can live within time and continue to make use of it. We can continue to grow. This Sunday night, Jews around the world will mark a most sacred moment in time. And for us, experiencing that holy time is ultimately about the need to use our freedom within time to grow every day, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow, as we ponder the insight given to us by Thoreau that we cannot kill time without injuring our eternity. Thank you very much for joining me, and Gemar Chatzimah Tovah.